Let's stand for prayer. And now, Father, at the beginning of this service, we invite your presence here. We ask that you would be present here to both direct in what is said and what is understood, what is communicated, that your kingdom might increase and we would understand and think the way you think and learn from the stories of the past so we not make the mistakes of the past, but choose the better way. And so help us to that end. I just invite your presence here to be with us and to grace all of us together as we wait before you. In Jesus' name, amen. Be seated. For our scripture to begin with, I would invite you to Joshua chapter 4. And I call your attention to verse 4. This is a story in the midst of a bigger story. And so I want to call us to a particular part of this story as it relates to the subject. Joshua chapter 4, verse 4. Then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had appointed from the children of Israel, one man from every tribe. And Joshua said to them, "Cross over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and each one of you take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, saying, 'What do these stones mean to you?' Then you shall answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. And these stones shall be a memorial to the children of Israel forever." Now jump down to verse 19. Okay, that was what was supposed to be done. 19. "Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones, which they took out of Jordan, Joshua set up in Gilgal. Then he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, 'When your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, "What are these stones?" Then you shall let your children know, saying, "Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed over, that all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, and that you may fear the Lord your God forever." Stop there. Do you see two purposes for stones? One of them is that we remember, and the other is that the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty. Now, just before we came over here to this service, Brother Allen took me over to Henry Egley's church, whatever the name of that is, and we looked at his stone. Henry Egley has a stone there. When I came back to this building, I got my books out, and I read what that stone represents, the story of Henry Egley in this area. Okay, we're not going there this morning, but it's recorded. Okay, now, the story that we're dealing with here in a larger fashion, do you know that as a people, we really shouldn't exist? Persecution should have wiped us out, and it did in certain places. It went down to nothing. But also, persecution is the roaring lion. When Satan deals with the people of God to the roaring lion, we say persecution. But do you know that freedom and prosperity has done to our people what persecution never could? The angel of light. We have lost more people to the faith through prosperity and peace than we ever lost in persecution. And so for that reason, there's a second reason we should not exist. Two of my children live in California and taught school among the persecuted church who came from Russia to California. And it's a very sad story. Those people who are persecuted, once they come into freedom, cannot handle freedom. They just lose their faith. Just like that. Here we are, who have, some of us have been here for 300 years, and some of us have been here less than 200 years, and the faith is genuine. I find it sitting right here. Why? Somebody paid attention. Somebody tried to think and understand the way God thinks and communicate some values. It survived persecution and now has survived prosperity to this moment. And I don't know how much further time will continue. But that's not even our job to figure out. Our job is to be prepared that the hand of the Lord may be seen that it's mighty. We have a martyr's mirror book about this thick that shows the mighty hand of God during persecution. We have a number of smaller books that tell us the story of how we held and did not hold to the faith during freedom and prosperity. It would be very interesting to stop here and talk about some local things right here that illustrate how prosperity and peace and freedom have not done well for this community. But that's not my assignment. So you have to check the books on that. My assignment does relate to what we call the Dutch Mennonites. And so I'd like to begin with that and spend the rest of the time now, this afternoon and this evening, dealing with their story. This is not what I had. We'll take some lights off. This is not what I had last night, but it's another overhead that reminds us of an important truth. Memory is a conscious work of interpretation, marked as much by deletion as by selection. How a community remembers its past is the most important element in determining its future. I invite you to think about that. You folks are a young church here. How you remember your past, where you come from. Your bigger story, out of which your local story comes from. How you understand the past is the single most important element in you going forward as a church, and whether or not you're going to survive for 100 years. Please think about that. Okay, let's localize what we're going to be talking about. We looked last evening about the story that developed out of Switzerland, and now we're going to be thinking about the story that develops out of the Netherlands. You notice that England is just across the English Channel over here. Here's Ireland. And over in here is Germany. Okay? Now we're going to zoom up closer. Down here is Switzerland once again. Here's Bern. Here's Basel. Here are the Jura Mountains, where you folks came from. Now, if you notice up here, we have the Netherlands. Here is Flanders. Here is Belgium. Here is Brussels. Rotterdam is the city from which many of our people sailed to come to this country. It's in the Netherlands. You'll notice in this particular map, this is Friesland. It's the northern part of the Netherlands. And right there is Pingjum. And right beside it is Witmarsum. When my son and my father were traveling, we decided we want to go visit Pingjum because that's where Menno Simons was preaching. And lo and behold, we got there and they were having church. And it was on a Thursday. Well, we didn't know it, but Europe closes down and has a holiday on Ascension Day, secular and sacred. It's not just a religious holiday. Everybody closes down. And they were in church. So we got courageous enough to open up the door of the church to see what was going on inside. Then we closed it right away because we could see it was in session. I thought, well, what should we do? Shall we try it again? So we tried it again. And the next time we cracked the door, somebody inside went like this. Come on in. So we went in. And we were in the church and watched somebody preach from the very same pulpit that Menno Simons used to preach from. And, of course, he was preaching in Dutch. And we couldn't understand. I'm talking about Holland Dutch now, not Pennsylvania Dutch or Swiss. This is real Dutch. But as soon as it was over, people came to us and wondering why we're here, what we're interested in. I said, well, we understand that Menno Simons used to preach in this church. Yes, they knew that. And so we're Mennonites, and we're interested. Oh, yes, they understand. Welcome. I wanted a picture of the preacher standing in that pulpit. But I didn't want to take a picture while the service was going on. And so I told the preacher that, and he said, thank you for not taking a picture during worship. So he says, I'll go get my robes on again. So he went and put his robes on, and then I took another picture of him standing in the pulpit. Now, folks, this is not a Mennonite church. This is a Reformed church. And there's a story behind some of this. I'll just tell you a little bit later. But later on, Menno worked over here in Witmarsum. So this is Menno Simons' territory. This is where it all began. In fact, if you know the story of Munster, right there is where Munster took place. It's one of the reasons why we, the Dutch Mennonites, exist, because of the terrible debacle that happened at Munster. That's a whole story in itself. I don't think I should go there right now. Let's go a little closer. Zoom it up even closer. Last night I talked about Dordrecht. Right there is Dordrecht. Here's Rotterdam. Up here is Pingjum, where we were just showing. And you'll notice that this is just full. It says towns having Mennonite congregations. Look at that. The Netherlands was just full of Mennonite congregations. Do you notice down here there's almost nothing? This is Flanders. Down here in Flanders, the persecution was so intense, they wiped Anabaptists out. And the people that survived fled north. The people who were from Flanders are called Flemish. The people who were from the north were called Friesians. And the two people had a different cultures. I might talk about it a little bit later. They're both Dutch, but their cultures were so different that they really couldn't relate to each other. And even in their churches. That's a story in itself. Maybe I'll tell you about that later. You say, well, Christians should be able to transcend culture. I grew up the old Mennonites. And now I work among Beachy Amish Mennonites. And it is like this. I come from one culture. They come from another culture. And it is not as easy as saying, get over it. There are real issues to deal with. No simple answers. Okay, we'll just leave that. Now this overhead points out the fact that not only were there Mennonite congregations in the Netherlands, over here is where we were talking about, but you'll notice throughout North Germany, up in here, even into Holstein, up here is Denmark. These are the congregations that developed, especially as persecution started to push these people east. Menno Simons himself is buried right there. Right there is where Menno Simons is buried. Far from where he used to work. He started his work over here, ended up over here. He died a natural death. Okay, so when Melchior Hoffman and others started preaching in these towns, Anabaptism was born in the Netherlands. Not just in Flanders, Zeeland, Holland, Friesland, all the coast provinces became homes for these persecuted Anabaptists. But Charles V had a son by the name of Philip II who were very zealous Roman Catholics. And when some Protestant influences began to make themselves known in the Netherlands and across in England, Philip II decided that we've got to deal with this. Roman Catholics are suffering. And so he assembled the Spanish Armada. You might remember studying about that in history. They outfitted some of the best ships possible, set a nice big army with those ships, and also had an army traveling along the coast on land because they wanted to destroy Protestantism in England. Well, when they got there, the English had smaller ships that actually caused a rout among these Spanish Armada ships, and they fled. When they fled north, they fled they were assembled down here in Spain. I'm not sure where they started in Spain. But anyway, they came up in here and they came into this English channel, and in here is where they got trapped. And these English set fire to their ships, and the ships to escape went up around this way. Well, when they got up in here, they met wind. And the wind destroyed as many ships as the English did down here. And only half the ships ever got home. I think there were like 188 ships. And Philip II was just devastated. He was trying to protect the true faith. And here, the true faith was destroyed and defeated. He could not fathom this. He said, "I sent my men out to fight with men, not with wind." Okay, that was in 1688. The persecution that happened at the beginning was with Catholics persecuting. Well, as time went on, then the whole religious thing changed, and we had the Reformed faith, or Calvinism, come in, and most of Holland they switched from Catholic to Presbyterian, or we call Reformed. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself here. Let me just back up and point out a few other things. Philip II issued an edict in 1556, this is Catholic now, forbidding all laymen to discuss or teach the Holy Scriptures on penalty of death. Men were to be executed with a sword. Women were to be buried alive. If the women persisted in their errors, they're going to burn too. Always their property was confiscated. Anabaptism was to be ruthlessly destroyed. And it was in Flanders. And as a result of this, no other group in Europe can claim as many martyrs as the Mennonites did. Between 1531 and 1,600 more Mennonites were put to death for the sake of their religious convictions in the Netherlands alone than from all the religious groups in England during the same period. And so it's doubtful whether any other people in Europe suffered the ravages of religious intolerance and political oppression as did the Dutch people in the lowlands under Charles V and his son, Philip II. But the mighty hand of God was there. And as we pointed out, they began to migrate under this heavy persecution. First of all, the people from Flanders migrated north, and then they began to migrate east. Okay? Common sense. Jesus says, they persecute you in one city, go to the next. So they did that. They migrated toward more tolerant areas. So Flanders emptied out of Anabaptists by 1600. 65 years, it was gone. But where did they go? As I said, some of them went east. Some of them actually went west across the English Channel to England. And of course, some of them went so far east to Prussia along the Vistula River. The last Dutch Mennonite martyr, according to Martyr's Mirror, was executed in Leeuwarden, which is on the close to where Menno was working, in 1574. In the south, a woman was burned alive in Brussels in 1597. Okay, but that's it. It was intense at the beginning. But by 1600, Holland was basically moving into freedom. Now, our people down in Switzerland were not. But I'm not talking about that story. We're focusing on the Dutch story right now. Now, let me point out something to you on a map here. This does not have it. I don't see that one with it either. Okay, well, I'll just point out approximately where it is. Okay, you see Antwerp, which is right here. Not too far away is the town of Ghent. I just don't see it marked on here. It's close by. How many of you read the book In the Belly of a Whale, or In the Whale's Belly? You might even have it at your house. It's stories of martyrs for children. Okay, my father and my son and I visited the castle at Ghent, where that story took place. And if you have a chance to visit that area, don't miss that. It's a castle where more than 110 Anabaptists were put to death. And in that castle, they have collected the instruments of torture that they used to use, not just in that castle, but other places. I didn't know about this, but one of the instruments of torture was that they would put a person in a metal chair, say in the middle of a room, and then it would put an iron collar around their neck. The iron collar stood about 4 inches high, and it had spikes out all around. They would fasten this iron collar on the person as he's sitting on the chair, and this iron collar had four wires that went to the four directions in the room. This side, that side, this side, this side. So that you had to sit perfectly still so that these points would not jag into you. And then they lit a fire under the chair. And they said in that museum that nobody could stand that torture for more than two or three hours. They just went insane. They just lost their minds. And you think, how in the world do people invent and dream up things like this? And there's other instruments. I better not say too much here for the sake of the children. Maybe we'll talk more about that later. It's worthwhile taking your older children to that place to see. You will not come out the same. Meadowhof in northern Indiana reproduces one thing from that castle. There is a dungeon in that castle. If you've been to Meadowhof, you go to the dungeon room and you look down inside. You see somebody sitting down there. Well, you can go to that castle and you can look down inside. That is the dungeon. Perhaps half of the 1,500 martyrs in the Martyrs' Mirror were from this Dutch region. And those 1,500 martyrs accounted for 3/4 of all the Protestant martyrs. Last night, I talked to you about Menno's incorrect doctrine in relation to the Incarnation, and how that created divisions in the churches. Okay, the Flemish people that I showed you that were from down here were not as strict with this as the people up here with this. The Flemish were less rigid with the ban, and the leaders had less arbitrary control over the church. The Flemish down here wore finer clothes. The Friesians up here, the leaders were more in control of things, told the church what's going to happen. They wore plainer clothes. They lived in plainer houses. They had leaders such as Menno Simons, Dirk Phillips. These people had a separate existence as they moved east into other areas of less persecution. They lived separately among each other, like I told you Amish and Mennonites do yet today. They maintained their separate existence for almost 200 years. And if a Flemish wanted to go join a Friesian church, they were excommunicated. And if it was the other way around, if a Friesian wanted to go to a Flemish church, they were excommunicated. So the excommunicated members were intermarried and rebaptized as they switched back and forth. But the Waterlanders, which were over here right on the water, it's not a town. It's a group of people who live right in here. Early on said, look, there's a real problem with this. And so they decided they're not going to have this strict shunning and all this stuff back and forth between the two groups. And so they early on became most liberal, but not most numerous. They disagreed with Menno's view of the Incarnation and this strict banning and shunning that we're talking about. But they did hold to some other basic Anabaptist doctrines. Okay, when they left up on this, they soon began to drift to marrying outside their churches and began to participate in the government. They began to associate with non-Mennonite businessmen. They soon began to pay their preachers, and they soon began to have audible prayer in church. All right, now that's just a quick overview snapshot of the three groups. Okay, we'll probably have some more to say about these things later. Now, the Quaker founder by the name of George Fox was likely influenced by the Anabaptist teaching, including non-resistance. George Fox and William Penn repeatedly visited these Dutch Mennonites, trying to help them convert from being Mennonite to Quaker. And eventually some of those did move to Pennsylvania after Philadelphia was founded in 1683. Last night I talked about that. Those are the ones that settled in Germantown. Okay, but it was never very many, only a few. But what I want you to carry away from this is that Quakerism has a strong root in Anabaptism. Now, secondly, the Baptist denomination traces its beginnings to these same people, the Dutch Mennonites, especially the Waterlanders. Now, they claim Menno Simons as one of their heroes. But they jump over him and go back to Balthasar Hubmaier, who was martyred back in Switzerland early on, I think like 1527. He was the best theologian Anabaptism ever had. He was a very trained man. But he did not believe that Christians need to lay down the sword. He believed that Christians could fight and hold office. And for a while, the Lords von Liechtenstein became Anabaptist. If there was ever a place that almost became an Anabaptist state, it's the country of Liechtenstein, which is on the eastern side of Switzerland, between Switzerland and Austria. Okay, they were the most numerous. And out of that group, the Hutterites formed. The Hutterites became known as the Stabler. These other Anabaptists who would take up the sword were called the Schwertler. Well, eventually, the Schwertler died out, and the Stabler have remained them to this day. Again, the mighty hand of God was at work. That's a very long story. The Hutterite story is a complete different story than this story. It is one of the most fascinating, tragic stories you will read. Now, back to the Baptists. I want you to understand that the Baptists claim Anabaptist roots. And they do, partly. But it's not quite fair to say that they have bought into all the basic Anabaptist teaching, because on this issue of non-resistance, there's a major difference. Of all the people we relate to here in America, the Baptists are the most similar to Anabaptist people, theology-wise. Thirdly, the English Congregationalists across the strait over here, across the English Channel, also acknowledge a heavy spiritual debt to these Dutch Mennonites. So what I want you to carry away from this is the Anabaptist movement was a very influential movement. I can't talk to you much about this right now, but I want you to know this. All young people should know that Anabaptism has actually changed the course of Western history, because they were the pioneers of the idea of separation in church and state. And this is the reason they were so heavily persecuted, because the church, like the Roman Catholic Church, like Charles V and Philip II, understand that you have to have church and you have to have state. It's like warp and woof in cloth. If you separate the warp from the woof, the cloth just falls apart. They could not imagine how you could have a society where church was separate from state. Nobody did it that way. And if the very first reason for persecuting Anabaptism was not their religious beliefs, but it was this concept. It was a criminal offense. You are destroying society. You're going to cause society to break up. And we cannot tolerate that. So get rid of them. This is a dangerous idea. And so they killed them rapidly. Now here's the irony of history. And this is the mighty hand of God. It's just amazing to me. All young people need to know this. Sometimes Anabaptist young people are kind of like, they have their heads down, they're kind of embarrassed, they don't know. It's kind of embarrassing to be an Anabaptist. Well, people who believe that way do not know the story of the mighty hand of God. Here's what happened. When Europeans began to come to the United States, to the colonies, the Puritans, who were Calvinists, settled up in New England. And they established a state church in New England. And they were willing to persecute, I think even to death, some Quakers in New England. So there was a firmly established state church in New England. The Church of England settled Virginia and some Carolinas. But they also had a state church down there, but it was not quite the same. There was Puritan up here and Anglican down here. Both have roots in the Church of England, which is the Protestant Church of England. But in between was Pennsylvania. And William Penn, with his holy experiment, did the unthinkable. He's inviting these persecuted Quakers and these persecuted Anabaptists to come to Pennsylvania to live. And there was no state church. And lo and behold, one Moravian said, "It turns out that we're all moving among each other like fish in the water.
and nobody's fighting, and society is not falling apart. And when it came time to write the U.S. Constitution, they did not use the pattern in New England or Virginia, even though Virginia is where it was written. Instead, they used the Pennsylvania model and built separation of church and state into the U.S. Constitution. And that has worked so well. Now, for over 200 years, the United States is trying to export the idea to Muslim countries. Well, Muslim countries have no philosophical base for a separation of church and state. Islam is church and state together. It has to be. When you talk about Sharia law, that's the way Islam is. They cannot even have separation of church and state. And so, Anabaptism has had more influence on history than most of us realize. And I just wish our young people would really get a hold of that, because it's very significant. Okay. But when the persecution left off in Holland here, the Dutch Mennonites began to decline, both spiritually and numerically. Now remember, I talked to you earlier about the Russians in Sacramento when they come over here. There's something about stepping out of persecution into freedom that's very difficult to handle. And so now I'm going to tell you the story from here on as to what happens when you lose persecution, the effect of it. There was a young Mennonite minister in Holland by the name of Tielman J. Van Brought, who began, I think he was born about 1632, something like that, and he began to notice that the grandchildren of the martyrs were losing their faith. Where the fathers had paid the price of their faith with blood, the grandchildren were willing to, well, so what? That was nice. I admire them, but I don't need that. And this alarmed him. Tielman Jan van Brought could see the significance of their faith. And so, it had a different title. I can't even say it right now. I apologize. But it was just a thin book of martyrs. But the Martyrs' Mirror, as time went on, they kept adding stories and more stories and more stories until finally in 1660, Tielman J. Van Brought had this book of about 1,000 pages of stories. If you have a martyr's mirror at home, and you've looked in it, you can see it's just one story after the other. And at the very end, right before it was published, they started putting our stories in. But our stories are only just a couple pages at the end. I don't know, was it 10, 30 pages? Just at the end. Now, it's very interesting that the Swiss Brethren people are the ones who treasure this book. The Dutch Mennonites to this day, yeah, they know about it, but they don't treasure it. Even though it's their stories. Okay, Tielman J. Van Brought puts this book together for the grand descendants of the martyrs so they would not lose their faith. It was an effort to help them keep their faith. For some reason, after this was published, the last edition was published with pictures in 1685. And your martyr's mirror that you have at home probably is the version or the edition that has the pictures, the Van Lauken etchings, which has really contributed to the martyr's mirror. Okay, then it ended. There was no more stories. In this country, in Franconia Conference, whenever the French and Indian War was brewing, Tielman Kolb and Henry Funk thought about Martyr's Mirror and said, we ought to have that translated from Dutch into German so our young people can read the stories and be prepared and fortified against this war that's coming. So they wrote over to the Dutch people and said, would you mind, we're kind of poor over here in America, would you mind financing a translation from Dutch to German so that we'd have this. The Dutch Mennonites did not answer. They wrote to them a second time. Would you help us? Bad, we're seeing clouds on the horizon here. No answer. And so they decided, well, we have to have this. So they approach the Efrater Cloisters and ask if the Efrater Cloisters would do this. And those of you who know some of the story of Efrater Cloisters, there was a man by the name of Peter Miller there. And Peter said, yeah, we'll do it. It took them several years to do this. Can you imagine translating that thick book? But they did. I think maybe it took them 5 years. I forget the number on that. And lo and behold, they produced the Martyr's Mirror in German. Okay. Move forward. Scroll forward to the year 2010. We'll say it's just 6 years ago. We are beginning to see clouds on the horizon. We are thinking that persecution may come here again. And some people remember Tilman J. Van Braught. He wanted to put stories together. People remembering Dielman Kolb and Henry Funk wanted to have stories for their children and their young people. And once again, we're thinking about stories. And so there was a group of people assembled in a Bearing Witness project to collect stories once again. And I know Alan knows this. I don't know what he did. He got a whole box at the Last Man Baptist Identity Conference of stories. For some reason, after 1660, our people stopped even collecting stories. Now, within the last few years, there's a new interest in collecting stories of costly discipleship. And this Bearing Witness is the first book. And there are other single books. Coals of Fire is the closest other book like this. Stories of Costly Discipleship. I'm hoping that the Bearing Witness book is just the first of many. And I'm hoping that our young people will get off their cell phones from texting and doing all kinds of other things and read these stories. Because we got tough times ahead of us. And we better get fortified once again for whatever the Lord may have for us. Okay. Back to Tilman J. Van Braught. The Martyr's Mirror that he put together with so much labor, I guess you could say was smiled at. People appreciated it, but they didn't take heed to it. In 1700, remember, this thing was published with the engravings in 1685. And he was already putting this together because he saw that these people were beginning to decline. But in 1700 yet, there were 160,000 Mennonites in Holland. It was one-tenth of the whole population of the country. By 1820, a little over 120 years, or we could say roughly 100 years, the population of Mennonites dropped from 160,000 down to 30,000. They lost 100 churches in 100 years. And you could say, why? Well, I'd like to share with you some of the reason why. At this point, I'm just share with you what I've discovered. They grew rapidly. They had to pay a price for their faith. People admired their faith. And back at Ghent, where I was talking about that castle, they had to execute people inside the castle walls after a while because people, if they wanted to make them a public example, but when they killed them outside the castle walls, people said, wow, what glorious dying. I want what those people have. And so it became a means of adding to the church. The blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church. And so the authorities said, look, we've got to stop this. We're going to have to start executing Anabaptists inside the castle walls so people can't see what we're doing. Okay. But once the persecution ended, this is what set in to explain the decline from 160,000 down to 30,000. Number one, worldliness. the prosperity, do you get that word? Prosperity and affluence of these diligent people inclined them to upward social mobility. They went up. Both in the amount of money they had, the kind of clothes they wore, the kind of houses they lived in, the kind of business they did. They looked around. Some of their neighbors were whalers, and they became whalers. Some of their neighbors became painters. They became painters. When they saw the opportunities that they had because of their increased wealth and freedom, they just went for it. They wanted to be like the world in Holland. But they had a problem. There was a stigma against being Mennonite. The possibility of upward social mobility was hindered by the stigma of their religion with its uniqueness of simplicity, austerity, and non-resistance. And thus, being Mennonite did not fit with the direction that they were moving. So what do you do about that? I don't know enough to answer this question, but it's in my mind. There's a reason why they're not called Mennonites over there. They're called Doopsgezinde. Might it be for that reason? Okay? Thirdly, the youth were educated in a system that did not honor God. Now, there weren't really schools like we have around today, but there was educational influence. And I don't know what they used for curriculum. All I know is that the system that they bought into did not reinforce their values. It reinforced Dutch values, the values of the people around them. To translate that into language that we understand is they went to public schools. They used public educational materials. They thought that necessary to get education so that they could continue to progress. If father went this far, son needs an education so he can go the next step higher. And that son, in order to continue to progress, needed to get more education so he could go the next step higher. And you can see where that goes. Fourthly, men refused ordination. It didn't pay to preach. So in a time when prosperity was abundantly available, men refused ordination so that they could spend time in their occupations and make money. Fifthly, in the neighborhood here, the Calvinists do quite well. It is part of their worldview. It's a part of their theology. You have to train men in seminaries to preach. You cannot have lay people just start preaching. And it's a whole subject. I don't want to go there. And so these people, their neighbors, the Dutch Reformed people, had schools to train preachers. Well, if the neighbors are training their preachers, we ought to train our preachers. And so, the Mennonite young men went to their seminaries. Now, guess what they taught in those seminaries? Do you think they taught Anabaptism over there? Of course not. And they believed what those seminaries taught. And for some reason, seminaries are not just simply places where you learn theology. They also have a history and a reputation of being theologically liberal. And so they bought into not only Calvinism, but into liberalism. And thus, the seminaries did the opposite of what they were intended to do. As a consequence, non-resistance was lost. The Dutch Mennonites became involved in political process. Their patriotism did not allow them to continue the non-resistant position. And so by World War II, there were only 3 Mennonite conscientious objectors in all of Holland. And the story I would have to tell you after break here is the story of a church. We're going to focus on this area, but it's going to be in Prussia. And I'll just introduce it with the idea of how Mennonites became Nazis. And that's directly a part of this story. Okay, moving on. Let me pause right here and show you some pictures. How many of you have ever heard of the painter Rembrandt? Some of you pay attention to some art. He is probably one of the most famous Dutch artists. His pictures are prized to this day. Well, he lived among the Mennonites. Here is one of his most famous pictures. That's a Mennonite preacher. You can't see that very well. If you want to see a better picture of it, come to see me afterwards. That's a very poor picture. Mennonite, that's what it's entitled. Mennonite minister, Mennonite preacher Angelo. This is probably his wife. He's talking to her. It's a very good picture. You can't see it on that very well. Here's another picture he painted. This man is a Mennonite. So Rembrandt was very familiar with Mennonites. And when Mennonites saw that all these people were doing all this beautiful art, many Mennonites became artists as well. And so the Mennonites fully participated in what is called the Golden Age of Holland. The prosperity and the arts that developed, the Mennonites thoroughly invested themselves in it. Okay, I think we'll leave that now, and we're going to pick up the story of the people moving east. I'm sorry, I lost track of time here. What time did I start? Okay. I realize that persons can only sit so long and it can only take so much in. All right, I'll continue here for a little bit. When persecution ended, then the migration east also ended. I said that when persecution happened, they went up this way, and then they went this way. And one of their major destinations was the Vistula River Delta, further east here. But when persecution stopped, they stopped. They just parked right there. They held their own for a period of time until about 1700. I already told you that story. And part of that story in freedom is that Menno Simons died a natural death while serving the churches at Westenfeld area. That's where his body is buried to this day. I've already showed you that. Now, I'll talk more about the results of this this afternoon later. But when the Mennonites moved over to Prussia, they were welcome because they knew how to drain the land. And they knew how to make money. They knew how to benefit the community. But really, they weren't too much appreciated. They were tolerated, but not appreciated. And they had real strict laws. They could buy this much land, and that's it. You could not buy any more land. You had to stay within your land. And if your children married, they had to marry within your people. Anybody who married outside the people, who married a non-Mennonite, the children of that marriage could not be Mennonite. They were not allowed at all to reach out and evangelize their neighbors. Zero. By the government. The government would not tolerate that. In fact, they were so on edge that they had to pay money to the government just to exist there. Remember, they're valuable economically, but they were not really welcome. And to keep them down, the government put all these restrictions on it, on them. And basically the Mennonites says, okay. And they just made do with it. Eventually the problem got so bad that they couldn't expand. They were all hemmed in. That Catherine the Great from Russia, who was from Prussia, knew about these people, and just when they were at about the bursting point, she invited these people to come to Russia. And when that door opened then, that's where people moved over to Kortice and Molochna. That's another story. I don't want to go there right now. I want to stay in Germany and talk about some of the things that happened in Germany first. The Krefeld Church, you'll notice right in okay, I don't see it on this map, Krefeld. Okay, it's approximately right in here. Okay, you'll notice it's pretty close to the Netherlands. But it's not actually in the midst of everything else. This is just one little story. It seems like wherever these Dutch Mennonites went, wherever, and it's still happening to this day, wherever they go, economic prosperity just happens. How many of you have ever been to Mexico and have seen what the old colony Mennonites do to the deserts of Mexico? None of you. If you want something to make your eyes pop, just go to Mexico. You're driving along in the desert, and suddenly, boom, right there. Grain bins, fine houses, trucks, elevators, real expensive farm equipment. How in the world? These people have the reputation of maybe able to make crops grew out of rocks. I don't know what it is about them, but they just turn, whatever they touch turns to gold. Okay? Well, the reason it does is they've been willing to irrigate land, pumping out of wells. The bad news is they've been pumping these wells for so long that the water table in Mexico is going down and down and down, and some of their wells are already going dry. And I cannot understand why they have so much capital into an area where they're going to run out of water. Well, some of them have already gotten the point that there's not a way forward long term in Mexico. It's just too much desert. So a bunch of them have moved to Bolivia. Bolivia is the new haven. And someone told me just since I'm here that their number in Bolivia today is about 100,000 of these people. And once again, wherever they go, they make things prosper. Okay, it seems like it's always been that way. So in the Krefeld Church, the Krefeld Mennonites played a leading role in the financial and industrial affairs of the city. And as leading industrialists, they become wealthy. And so they pay the most taxes. They pay one third of all the taxes. Okay, so if you pay taxes, you're entitled to elect your officials in the city, the governing body. And so the Mennonites just went up and up and up financially, and finally they're in government running the place. And so the Mennonites became the top level, the top strat of society, and the Protestants were below them, and the Catholics were at the bottom. The great mass of the population. And their big industry in Krefeld was silk. Was silkworms. That's a whole story. We're not going to go there this morning. Okay, so now I'm going to leave that part and just follow these people as they go east now over to the Vistula area, Danzig area of Prussia. And this will be in preparation for what I share later on. In 1534, while persecution is going on, Danzig, the city of Danzig,
probably ought to show you exactly where Danzig is. Okay, we've been focusing here in the Netherlands. Danzig is right there, almost off the map. We call it Poland today. Okay, that's how far we're talking about. Okay, in 1534, while persecution is persecution just started, because in 1534 the city of Danzig wrote to Amsterdam over here requesting that no Anabaptists be permitted to board ships to go to Danzig, because some of them were getting there and they wanted to stop any more coming. But enough got there somehow, and they began to do their work in spite of the fact they're not supposed to be there, and done such good work in turning the swampland into productive farmland that the government had to say, you know what? It's okay for these people to be here. In fact, we could use some more of them. Because they actually did turn swampland into pastures or grain fields, and that was beneficial to the whole country. And so more settlers went over from Holland, from Friesland, and from Flanders and elsewhere. And these people were all fleeing persecution. Dirk Phillips, you probably heard that name, he was the first elder in the Danzig church. Menno Simons actually visited this place also in 1549. My notes here say a Danzig banker invited Mennonites from Holland to come to do the land drainage work on the Vistula Delta. Also, two Mennonites who evidently had some money bought large areas of land for drainage and settlement. And they invited their own people back in Holland to come over to help with this project. And the plan was repeated other places. And so, in the process of time, we have numerous Mennonite villages that sprung up in the Vistula Delta area. By law, these Mennonites were not permitted to live in the city of Danzig. See, they're just tolerated. If you come here, nobody may live in the city. You've got to live in the countryside. But by 1550, which is not that long into the story, a large congregation had developed right outside the city walls. But once again, these people are so industrious that their skills are recognized. And so, because of these skills, they said, you know what? Why don't you all come into the city now? So, some of them moved into the city. Now, the Mennonites that moved inside the city retained their Holland Dutch that they brought with them over there. But the people outside the city, who had to live and work among the natives, did not retain their Holland Dutch. They learned Plattdeutsch. Now, Plattdeutsch is Low German. You folks speak a dialect of High German. Pennsylvania Dutch is a dialect of High German, and I think your Swiss dialect here is also, it's also High German. High German simply means high elevation. It comes from the mountains of southern Germany. Down here, it's mountainous. Up here, obviously, if the land is low, when the river enters into the sea, it's like elevation of 5 feet or less. That's low. That's called the low countries. These people over here live in the low countries. Some of them are so low they're below sea level. Okay? Well, this is where Plattdeutsch, or Low German, developed. And these people, when they moved to Russia, took their Low German with them, their Plattdeutsch, to Russia. And this became so much a part of their identity that now, that is a defining characteristic of those people, Plattdeutsch. It's almost like a part of their faith. If you can't speak Plattdeutsch, there's just something wrong. That's a whole story. We won't go there. The Mennonites of the Danzig area lived under four separate political divisions. Some were more tolerant than others. Some lived under a Catholic division. Some lived under a Lutheran division. But by 1800, all were combined under one king in Prussia.
At no time did the Mennonites enjoy the privileges held by those of the state churches. At first, the Mennonite worship was tolerated, was not allowed to grow. Anything that might promote growth beyond their immediate circle was forbidden. I've already talked about that. No proselytizing. Worship must happen quietly and in private homes only. Church houses were not allowed until 1600. And then, if they built a church house, it was under restrictions. Then here's the repeating story. The Mennonite prosperity aroused the envy of their less thrifty neighbors. The neighbors looking on and saying, how in the world are these people prospering like this? Why can't we prosper like this? Because they were of foreign origin from Holland did not help the matters. And because they were separate from society and they refused to adopt the culture of the surrounding area, that increased public resentment. But in spite of the resentment, they're prospering economically, financially. And so, by the middle of the 1600s, the political rulers discovered a good use of Mennonites. Not only did they develop the land and make that good, but they had so much money, they figured out a way to tax them. Now, these Mennonites would never send their young men to war, so they couldn't get their young men for the army, but they found a way to get their money. And so they taxed them and got their public money. And so 100 years later, by 1700, they were paying exemption tax, freeing them from military duty. And believe it or not, their exemption tax was used to operate a military academy. You might say, what in the world? They decided, I guess, that's the least of two evils. Support the school, just don't go out and use guns. By 1912, the Danzig Mennonites were almost exclusively descendants of the first Dutch settlers who had come in the 1500s. There were only 369 surnames. And I'll just mention the most numerous 14 surnames. Penner was the most common name. Weens, Dick, Klassen, Wiebe, Jansen, Enns, Jans, Nuffeld, Friesen, Reimer, Epp, Nickel, and Peters. Those are the top 14. Those names can be traced back to their Dutch origins as city dwellers or as Flemish or as Friesen. But remember now, these Flemish and Friesens are living beside each other over here, right there, but they are still separate. They will not intermarry. They cannot go freely from one church to the other without being excommunicated. They carried that with them. As a whole, both of those groups, both the Flemish and the Friesens, were known for caring for their own poor, their own sick, and their own elderly. They never allowed anyone of their own to become a public charge for society. And wherever they have gone, to this day, they do the same thing. They never make the government take care of their people. In their churches, they had a three-office minister. They had a song leader. He was a church official, and he's elected for life. They had an umbitter. That's an office in the church who went around just before communion to visit each family in the interest of spiritual unity. I guess it's in the place of examination meeting, what we would call council meeting. And of course, then they had ministers and elders. Here's another strange thing about them. They had no church members under the age of 20. They often joined the church at age 30 or more. There was no such thing as a public funeral among them, or even a funeral sermon before 1800. They weren't allowed to have funerals. Sometimes would write a poem with many verses and set it to a well-known melody And that was the funeral. By 1800, the Dutch language was dying out, and Low German, or Plattdeutsch, had taken over. By 1775, the Danzig Mennonites were beginning to feel new government pressure. They were not to purchase more land. They could not provide new homes for their young people. They needed to pay this tax to support this military academy. The government was trying to stop their growth, even though they valued them as business people. These people desired freedom to exercise their religious convictions without restraint. And so the question is, where should they go? And believe it or not, America, which is a new nation in 1776, was given no serious consideration. They didn't really know that much about America. Later on, America became known as the place, if you love pistols and adventure, you go to America. America was a place for criminals, not for people who are decent. And so if you wanted to be decent, you went east further. And that's what they went on to Russia then. And then I told you the story about Catherine the Great urging them to come to South Russia where they can enjoy all those privileges. I think maybe that's a good place to stop for now and take some questions. And we'll pick up this afternoon now with the story of how Mennonites became Nazis. But before we close out here today, I'll just open it up for questions. We can turn some lights back on. Do you have any particular questions? Yes.
I guess mine is not really a question, a comment. We're from Arthur, and they did that same thing. They turned the swampland into one of the most fertile places in the U.S. Between Arthur and Arcola used to be a wagon trail through the swamps. Today it is just a breadbasket. 200 bushel corn is the norm. 200 plus bushel.
I learned this afternoon before I came over here that this area was swamp at one time.
Really?
Look at it now. It seems like wherever Mennonites go, they know how to take swamps and turn them into productive land. Is that a good thing? It hasn't been good for Arthur. Doesn't God give us a dominion mandate? Aren't we supposed to take the earth and to subdue it? Isn't draining land subduing the earth and making it productive? Isn't that a good thing? I think it is. Maybe some people disagree with that. It's enterprising people. You know, when I get here and I look around and I see you folks are enterprising around here. You don't sit in the shade and fan yourselves quite often. You must be working when I see all the economic prosperity around there. Okay, so is that all bad? No. When people are enterprising and industrious, it generates capital. And so the real choice is what you're going to do with that capital. Either use it selfishly or to expand God's kingdom. See, to me, that's the crucial issue right here. Yes.
Well, that just generates a question. Do you know of any group of people that prospered continuously and were able to keep their faith? That's not fair, sorry.
I wish I could have a ready example.
Well, Wesley kind of said that himself. He said, at one time I thought you could have wealth and be a Christian, but towards the end of his life, he wasn't so sure.
He's the one that said, make all you can, save all you can, and then give all you can, which is true. But you know what? You know, let's just really be honest about it. Whenever it comes to giving, all of us like to, it's difficult to really sacrifice. It really is. It's hard on our flesh. And people, we're, as human beings, we're forever making excuses as to why we ought to keep more than what we should. It's just the way we are. And I think the record of history says that we're not alone. And this is a problem. In fact, it's been called God's dilemma. Have you ever heard this expression, God's dilemma? God just loves to bless, right? He's full of love and mercy and gifts. But whenever He gives these gifts to people, they look away from Him and they look at the gifts. They get preoccupied with the gifts and enjoying the gifts that they forget Him. And then so God has to say, look, that's not what I'm giving you the gifts for. You're supposed to be paying attention to Me. And so He has to discipline them in some way so they have their hearts turning back to Him again. Well, God wants to bless, but when He blesses, it makes problems. So what does He do? It's called God's dilemma. Well, I don't think we ought to try to figure out how God ought to do it. I think we ought to let Him decide that. We have enough problems to decide what we're going to do about it. Yes.
I have a couple of things here. Do you remember, do you happen to know roughly what year Menno Simons died?
Westenfeld is the town.
I say what year.
Oh, I could find it out for you.
Okay.
I think it was something like 1565, right off the top of my head.
1565, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and you said the Baptists are the most closest to us. You were thinking of all the people in the Protestant
world. In the Protestant world, yes.
Okay. And I was just curious, too, the Flemish and Friesen, they're still separated to this day?
No. As I would understand it, once they came across the water to the New World, they did not retain that distinction. Now, I'm not one of those people, so I'm probably a poor one to answer that.
Okay.
When they came across with other distinctions. For example, when they came across from Russia, the whole Alexanderwald church came. Now, if it was Flemish or Friesen, I don't know. But it came as a church. Well, then there was the old colony people, like the Furstenlanders, which were a daughter colony of Cortiza. They came as a group. Were they Flemish or Friesen? I don't know.
Okay.
It's like they didn't come as Flemish or Friesen, they came as other kinds of groups.
Have you ever read Brother Boris's blue book?
Brother Boris's blue book?
His name is Boris. You haven't heard, seen it, maybe I should get you a copy of it. Maybe. I was just curious. It has a lot of the migration, some things on the Russian.
Okay.
I don't know. But... Okay. I was wondering, you start out by talking about us remembering our past. I wondered if you had any more comments on practical ways or any more insight on that.
On what, again?
On remembering our past. You started out with that.
Yeah.
I didn't know if you had any more comments or anything else.
Yeah, I was tempted to violate my promise to you. I was reading some books that I brought along. Brother Allen took me over here to Henry Egley's church. I snuck in one little comment, but I opened the book up and let Alan read the story of the Egley Amish that are here. And what happened up in Elkhart with John Funk and all that. Yes, there are many more things we could say.
Okay.
But I'm limiting myself. I'm trying to be nice.
Okay.
Get the books and read them for yourself is what I say. Okay, since you asked that question, Brother Allen, would you go to where I'm studying over there and bring my three books to me, and I'll read to you something about... Last night, the story came up about the apostolic people. I would just like to read to you what it says about them and what it says about the Egley Amish that are right here in this area. Your people This ought to be a part of your educational system. Your young people ought to know about this kind of stuff by the time they're married. It's a part of your community here. You need to know why you are the way you are, why your community exists the way it does, why these people are. Like, I was impressed. We were over at this Eglise church over there and looked at the graveyard. It is just full of Anabaptist names. But I'm hearing that there are very liberal people. So what happened there? Well, that's what I would like to read to you as part of the story you should be learning about, you know, what's local here. And since we were there, we saw the church starts at 9 o'clock tomorrow. And I want to go inside. I could look through the window and I could see they had some historical things right inside. I don't know enough about these people. I want to know it myself.
You can tell the quote that Gretchen told us.
Well, you say it. Yeah, you say it.
What'd she say? Each generation is just one generation away from forgetting their story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Henry Eglise Church became known as the Evangelical Mennonite Church. Now, they took the name Mennonite off their name now. It's called what presently? Burn Evangelical Church. Okay. So why did they take the name off? Listen, the impetus leading to the founding of that group right over there in 1864 was again a personal experience of deep spiritual significance, this time on the part of Henry Eglise, an Amishman near Bern, Indiana. Because of his leadership, they were frequently known as the Eglise Amish, but called themselves the Defenseless Mennonite Church of North America until 1948, when they adopted the present name of Evangelical Mennonite, but now it's changed then, now since that. And it's not even called Mennonite at all anymore. This use of the name Defenseless was probably the most accurate translation of the German Wehrlos, which is today translated as non-resistant. As in the case of John Holderman, so Eglise charged the church. Get this. Eglise charged the church in his area, Amish, I guess, with indifference in things spiritual, especially in forsaking the genuine inheritance of the Mennonite fathers. Among these important essentials was the new birth. Soon, those who felt as he did and who had experienced conversion themselves joined him in separate meetings, which led to their formal organization as a group. A strong conservatism prevailed in dress and doctrine during the early years, but gradually the distinctive external masks of faith were discarded, including bonnets and beards. The practice of the holy kiss was largely abandoned. Musical instruments were introduced into the worship services, and English replaced the German language. The early zeal, however, continued. Several preaching services were held every Sunday. Sunday schools were organized in the 1870s, and regular evangelistic meetings were held once or twice annually. Missionary work was begun in what is now Zaire, which is the Congo in Africa, in 1896. Out of this program, the African Inter-Mennonite Mission, formerly known as the Congo Inland Mission, was organized in 1912 in cooperation with the Central Conference of Mennonites, now in the General Conference. Since 1949, mission activities have been carried on in the Dominican Republic and more recently in other countries also. The first annual conference of the Defenseless Mennonites was held in 1883, but formal organization was not complete until 1908. Blah, 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 there's a couple other things there. And it says in 1978, the total membership was 3,507, located especially near Bern, Indiana, Archbold, Ohio, and Gridley, Illinois. Okay, that's an overview. Okay, that's what this book, Introduction to Mennonite History, says. And if you go to this particular book, The Smith Mennonite, Smith's Story of the Mennonites, here's what he says. Another storm center developed among the Amish, first in Adams County, Indiana, and later in Illinois and Ohio. The leader of this new movement was Henry Eglise, a minister in the Amish congregation of that place. About 1864, Eglise began to urge the necessity of a definite conversion experience. His charge that the spiritual life of the time was too formal and was not based on vital experience may have had some ground, but the contention that the austere, simple dressed brethren of that day were too liberal in their dress regulations can hardly be taken seriously. In 1866, Eglise withdrew from the old church and formed a new one, which soon included the larger part of his former congregation. The movement later spread to Livingston and Tazewell counties, Illinois, where several large congregations developed. At first, Egli's followers were quite strict in their dress regulations and rather exclusive in their religious affiliations. They rebaptized all those of their members who had come from the Amish church, but who could not confess that they had been truly converted before, a confession which, under the circumstances, few would make. Through the years, the old ethnic barriers were gradually toppled through church extension and marriage. They were optional immersionists and have discarded the formal dress restrictions. At first spoken of as the Egli Amish by members of the church which they left, they later assumed the name Defenseless Mennonites. In 1948, the name was changed to Evangelical Mennonites. In 1978, the membership was 3,507 in 21 congregations. Their official church organ is the Communique. Okay? And now it is 2016, and the name Mennonite is gone. And one of the things, if we get a chance to talk to their people, I want to know how many members they have today. Because one of the common threads, when you read these stories, is that whenever people face charges of being legalistic and you got to start dropping things so that you become relevant, it seems like the way to bring people into the church. But eventually, it's why the church fails. And they lose members. And so here's Mennonite Church USA. In 1999 and around the year 2000, they wanted to merge the General Conference with the conferences. And this was the way forward. The church is going to grow and blossom. They did that. But instead of that going up, it's going down. Mennonite Church is a dying organization to this day. They stand for almost nothing. And so when you break down all the, quote, stuff that keeps people out, eventually you have nothing to stand for. And you lose members. The cry is relevancy. Except that you become so relevant you don't have anything eventually. So, there's this book, Mennonite Church in America, also has the story. So you can read the story in various versions. The answer to your question. Mm-hmm. Oh, if you wanted the story of the apostolics, I mean, I could read that too. That's in here too. Yes, Alan. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
We were talking about the prosperity and how that eventually people lose out in their faith. How about when there's, I'm just thinking of our own community, there's people that are from one end of the community to the other, some are far poorer than others, and it seems it's darker. What is your thoughts on that?
Okay, you're talking about some of the religious people who are in darkness or...
I'm talking about our Amish right in the community.
Yeah.
Some are not as prosperous as others because of they don't allow them to
okay.
do...
Gotcha. I understand what you're saying. Okay. Very good point. Okay, so is efforts to keep people poor the way to build spiritual life? No. Exactly. So we tend to think, well, if you let people become prosperous, they lose the faith. So therefore, if you keep people poor, they're going to retain the faith. And the answer is no. What retains the faith, folks? How do you retain the faith? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand this. What does it take? Believing in what? Okay, to have a living relationship with Christ. That is what it takes. Now, some people can prosper financially with a living faith in Christ. And so I'm going to say, bless you. Keep your living faith. Some people who want to restrict themselves more, they actually practice more of the spiritual disciplines. If those spiritual disciplines can move them into a living faith, keep your living faith. Keep your disciplines. They're actually helpful if you don't worship them. But you have to have a living relationship with Jesus Christ. Yes?
If you're finished, I'm going to switch back over to Germany, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. We have to keep the commandments of God in our testimony of Jesus Christ. I appreciate mm-hmm. that. The Danzig, was it Danzig? Is that what you said? Were those people, Did they establish a colony? Was that a colony?
No.
They were still
scattered out.
They just
went over
out.
There because the swamps needed to be drained, and they were fleeing persecution in the West.
Okay. What was the first colonies in Russia or Prussia? Or that is Prussia?
That is Prussia.
Okay.
Danzig is Prussia.
The colonies were in Russia.
The colonies were in Russia. That's the next step.
Thank you.
Anything else? Over here. Sure. And this follows exactly right after Evangelical Mennonite Church, so it's the very next thing. Mention should be made of another disturbance among the Amish of Illinois and several other states in the early 1850s. The Neutaufer, described in the chapter on Switzerland, sent several emissaries of their faith to their former Swiss countrymen in Wayne County, Ohio in 1846, where they won a few converts. A little later, others came to the Amish settlements in New York, from whence, together with a few recruits from that latter place, they found their way to the Amish community in Woodford County, Illinois. Here, too, they succeeded in bringing about the secession of a few of the dissatisfied members of the Amish church and relatives of the New Yorkers. From Illinois, the movement was carried on to Butler County, Ohio, Amish settlement. This new group, which was locally known as among the Amish as New Amish, but among themselves as the Glaubig? I heard this word last night. Yeah. G-L-A-U-B-I-G-E. Okay. But among themselves are known as that, which means believers, had but a slow growth. By 1877, there were only 89 members in all the various communities. Their number and influence would have been insignificant and might have disappeared entirely had it not been for an additional immigration from Switzerland of recruits from their mother church. Today, there are a number of large and prosperous congregations in central Illinois and Indiana, with several in other nearby states. The Apostolic Christian Church, as it is officially known, is exclusive, and its members have no affiliation with other religious groups. They exercise a strict discipline among themselves, applying the practice of avoidance to all business and social relationships, as well as the religious fellowship, not even accepting husband and wife in case one or the other should be expelled from their communion. In business matters and as farmers, they are among the most industrious and uniformly prosperous members of the community. Wherever they locate, they have the finest farms and the best livestock, and the price of land immediately goes up. Their present connection with the Amish and Mennonites is that both in Switzerland and in America, their first converts came from the same places, and they do share with them some of the fundamental beliefs such as non-resistance, avoidance, a general spirit of nonconformity to the world, insistence upon plain, though not necessarily peculiar dress, and other traditions. Now, this is written a few years ago, so maybe that's not entirely accurate. This is the fifth edition. The first edition was in 1941. And then this one, this is a fifth printing in 1981. So it might be more than 20 years out of date already. Yes. I just know that it was one there, but...
what county Peoria is in. But I'm, see, there's an apostolic thread over in there, but there's also the Bern Evangelical of today has also got a thread over toward Peoria. I work with a man that attends that church who actually got his wife from Peoria. That was not so very far from where we used to live. And there is an Amish man in Arthur today that became Amish out of one of those groups. And I don't know which one. He came to the Amish there in Arthur, and he still is.
Okay, when it comes to Peoria and that story, I know very little. I'm sorry, I can't really help you. But I'm sure there are books around that you could find the information you're looking for.
I would have one, too.
Okay.
Okay, talk to Alan. He says he has something. Are we finished?
Thank you for your good attention. And I can see you're listening. I appreciate that. I guess, do you have announcements now about what we're going to do for the meal?